The topic is we can say sad. Yeah, is a sad topic, but in every darkness we can see a light. So we will try to see God's light in all this situation which is happening right now in Ukraine, in the Eastern Europe generally. So I'm Jaroslav Lukasik. I'm Polish, but God called me to serve people in Eastern Europe. So when I was 17, I received a calling from the Lord, and in 1993 went to Belarus. I founded a church there. I was a pastor during 14 years, but I was deported in 2007. So therefore, with my family, we moved to Ukraine. And all these last 15 years, I'm Ukrainian. and try to save in different project with our team in within the Eastern Europe Reformation Foundation. We are doing different projects for Ukrainian people now. So my English is very poor, really. So I will talk just a little from the beginning and maybe a little to the end. So our main speaker is Sasha. I think maybe, okay, so maybe now I think you can say something about you. Yeah, now it's a time of introduction, I think.
My name is Sasha. In passport, I'm Alexander. Come from Christian background, if you've heard in the plenary session yesterday. Had a really an honor to be born in a Christian home. Granddad, dad. Got 54 first cousins on my father's line. Yeah, indeed. My wife is from the family of 13. She's number 7. So I have 5 kids myself, 2 grandchildren. And, in 92, after I came from England from the Bible school, I began the ministry of the church in a town 10 miles outside of Kyiv City, a place called Vyshgorod. That's where the Museum of Corruption, our former president Yanukovych, is, if you heard anything about that. So didn't miss much if you didn't. So, but yeah, ever since, for 31 years, I've been pastoring there. The last 5 years, I've been given a job of looking after 50 churches in the Kyiv region in our network. That's about it. And Yaroslav has been a long-standing friend from 2010. I've known him and have a lot of respect. Our pastors in Ukraine have a lot of respect to a Polish guy who's given his life to Belarus for many years and now for the last 13 years to Ukraine. So thank you, Yaroslav.
Thank you. I think, Sasha, that with your experience of your family, demographic crisis in Europe is solved. Yeah, so we will follow you. I'm your younger brother. We have time still. Okay. So praise the Lord that we still have a sense of humor. In all this situation. Yeah. So what is happening in Ukraine? Yeah. So what is happening in Ukraine now? I think you are watching news now. So we are in time of real war. It's the same with what we watched in our childhood, watching movies about the Second World War is happening in Ukraine now. So for May this year, number of victims is 200,000 of Russian soldiers, 200,000 Russian soldiers. I think Ukrainians' number is similar, maybe some less, because defense is always less lost, yeah. So, but anyway, it's a big number of victims among civil population as well, among kids, women. So this is a really very brutal war with a huge number of victims. We are in this. We could not imagine this maybe several years ago, but it is a fact of this. Of this time when we leave. So I just want to make a very short introduction in the context of this war. because it's just I talked with many people from different countries about this, so I think there is some confusions. So from my point of view, there are two reasons why this war happened. One reason is like, let's say, local reason. So it's a imperial Soviet Russian revanchism. People among you who remember the time of collapse of Soviet Union, you could not imagine Soviet Union that Soviet Union will collapse without blood. Yeah, but it happened almost without victims. But things that didn't happen then are happening right now. After 32 years, let's say. Yeah, so all this is, and Ukraine, why Ukraine? Ukraine is very, very important for Russia, because Russia could not be an empire without Ukraine. Ukraine has all this historical legacy with Kiev Rus legacy that Moscow need for their imperial legend, for their myth, imperial myth. And also Ukraine is a big population, nation with a lot of Slavic people. So therefore, if Russia wants to remain like Slavic nation, mainly Slavic nation, so they want to have this population. And during these 30 years, Ukrainian population became a nation. Yeah? So Ukrainization of people, people start to use Ukrainian language, people start to study Ukrainian history. So all this identity, Ukrainian identity, was growing and growing and forming, shaping all this time. So Russia could not see this, because for like regular Russia's people, it's very difficult to imagine that Ukrainians are different nation. They think this is one nation. So therefore, Putin, in his speech, before the war started, he used such sentences. There is not such nation like Ukraine. So it's just a product of Lenin. He used sentences that Lenin created Ukraine. So the goal is just abolish Ukraine as a nation. So this is one aspect. Sure, there are some economical issues, but not so much. It's obviously that because of this war, everyone lost in economical sense, and Russia as well. So the most important reason is just imperialism, is an issue of ideological issue. The second one is more, it's a more globally reason. So it's a conflict for new world order. And I think it's even more interesting for people from other European or countries or from America, because many geopolitics or many historians, they say that it is something like conflict of civilizations now. Yeah, and Putin decide to strike the first, and if we use some patterns from ancient history, like from Rome history, you remember that Roman Empire was attacked in Limes. Limes was a frontier borders of Roman Empire. So the question of Ukraine is that Ukraine, year after year, is nearing to the Western civilization, is one of the Western countries, even it is Orthodox. But anyway, so it's the same political system, is the same culture, the same civilization sources. So therefore, he used another sentence. NATO should return to the borders from 1997. So this is not only conflict between Russia and Ukraine, but it's much more wider conflict. I think we could continue all these talks and like giving more arguments, but our goal here is talking about the church. It's talking about the challenges what this war brought and create, and talking how the church responds.
All right, friends, what challenges? What challenges? Number one, of course, challenge is the next slide, is the psychological trauma. On the 23rd of February was the birthday of my youngest grandson. And in the evening, we had a party in my home. That's only a few hours before that war began. And there was a lot of talk that it's going to start because all these troops are above Belarus. Kyiv is only 120 kilometers from Belarus, up north direct. That's where they attacked the capital. They wanted to take the capital, first of all. You remember that in February and March. And nobody believed. I could say that I was not ready for the war. We could not believe that would happen, honestly. The only thing that I said that last night, before we parted 11 in the evening, only 6 hours before the war, I said to my children, well, if that begins, you all have to be here in this house. They live within a distance of, you know, a couple of miles from me. You have to be here in 1 hour. They still made jokes on me, my boys. Little we knew that 4 in the morning it will begin. I woke up from 2 explosions because I live in the upper, in the northern part of the Kyiv region where there's a hydraulic power station. Of course, hydraulic power station is the one of the first objects, you know, that they wanted to. There's another 5, actually, strategic objects within a 2 kilometer distance where I live. And I woke up from 2 missiles exploding, and I remember I opened the curtain, and I've seen 2 mushroom smoke thing coming out. For 10 minutes, your legs are shaking like this. You're trying to be a man. Right away, I pulled the suitcases, of course, to send my wife away from this place. And this is a moment like you watch in the movies. She thought that I would go with her as I was closing the door of the van. She said, aren't you going with me? I took all your clothing in the suitcase. I said, absolutely not. I have a church here. I am staying here. You see some of those things in movies. As you say goodbye, hey, what's going to happen next? Next 11 days in Vyshgorod, in our town, 170 people slept in the basement. I've got footage. People who were scared, those first footage with helicopters, the first day, remember? They flew over my house, literally. Over my house, all those helicopters flew because it was in the north of Kyiv, over the Kyiv Sea, Made Sea. So for 11 days, we've been actually living in the basement. And then in the night from the 5th to the 6th, I'll take a few minutes to tell you the reality, to get you a little bit closer to the whole thing. And from the 5th to the 6th of March, 11 days later, in the evening with people sleeping in the basement of the church, I started texting to another pastor we both know, Valery Alimov. He got stuck in Makarov, in one of those northern cities near Bucha and Irpin. And he started saying, 1 week already, I'm stuck in the basement in the war zone. Only now it looks like I'm breaking away to pull out west. And he started telling me what's going on already, because by that time we did not know all the atrocities that Russians committed. By that morning, I already knew the atrocities they were doing. And that early morning, 1 in the morning on the 6th, which was Sunday, I said, I have to make a difficult decision. One of the most difficult decisions in 32 years of my ministry I made that night. First one was to disperse all the people from the basement, because when the Russians came into the town, church's bases would be a good, place for them. It was like a good kazarma. It's like a good place for them a good base for them. So for them coming there with like 4 or 5 infants were in the basement. young families, 40 kids. You know, all these 11 nights, you know, we're hiding in the basement. So I thought, I cannot afford to keep all these people here just in one spot, in one building. So for me to stand and say on the 4th in the evening, on Friday evening, this place is going to be empty, nobody's going to be here, it was like a Titanic talk on the in that Titanic. It's like, you know, who's going to... It was difficult. So, but I said, I made a decision, and nobody's going to be here. Everybody has to leave this place. Whether, of course, we evacuated 85% of the church. And the second biggest decision was the same day. I made a mistake. 4 days later, I brought my wife back from the Western Ukraine. Should never have done that. Women are created to take all that stuff. And she was shaken. My wife was shaken that night from the 5th, from Friday, from Saturday to Sunday, to the 6th. That Sunday, she was shaken. She was not taking this well. She said, let's get out of here. I said, please, Oksana, leave me alone. I'm a pastor still. I cannot just be, just, you know. And then on Sunday morning, on the 6th, we dispersed all the people. And sitting, actually, we evacuated all the people. We're sitting in the car. She's looking at me, and then she pulls the phone, and she says, read this. And there is a messenger group, Viber, where our street neighborhood has a group. And she reads, I read this. Just a few minutes ago, a sabotage group broke from the backyards into our neighborhood. 6 Russian soldiers have been shot by our men, and 4 soldiers started climbing into our backyards, into our gardens. I'm looking at her, and she like... And I said, I married you first, before I marry the church. Let's go. I'll take you safe. And what I said? Did you hear what I said? I married you first before I married the church. I will not be putting you through this. Because the night before, she was shaken. Okay, maybe I shouldn't have taken her back, but I did what I did. That's the war. The dynamics of war is absolutely amazing. You could never predict. Who could ever know that our leadership on the first day agreed the plan to do it, but all our leadership happened to be in the towns nearby. Block posts, checking points, shut the town. And none of the leadership would come to the town. None of the 3 guys of my leadership could come and take care of the church. I was left there alone. I could go on. The dynamics of the war is absolutely unpredictable, incredible. You never know what's going to happen. That was actually what happened the first day. A bit of my emotion of what we went through the first day. Of course, saying this, I realized that's not even close what some month later people in Mariupol went through, but to each, his experience is real, you know. Of course, that's probably only 2% compared to what the Mariupol people lived through, but that's our reality as the whole thing began, as they attacked us from the north, from the Belarus territory. The atmosphere of uncertainty. Death today is a very real thing. In our church, we have one family where in October they buried their son-in-law, and from Christmas time, 2 of their other cousin and his son, they're missing. One family, 3 people gone. My neighbor, 3 guy from my neighbors, friends all of my life, him and 2 of his sons are now at war. So, you know, the whole thing is very close to us. It's not the 2014 situation that happened in the East that didn't touch all that deeply everybody, because, you know, it was somewhere for us that day it became very, very real. You know, refugees, bombing. My daughter, first 6 months spent in the States because psoriasis was, well, her head was one big wound here, from here up to here. So I sent her to the States. She wasn't taken that well at all. She came back on the 3rd of October. And then 3 days later, on the 10th of October last year, they began systematically bombing us, all these kind of things. So. That was one other thing I'll say about the emotion there. The first meeting we had after I was away for like 5 weeks after we, you know, went west. The 5th week I was coming, the 3rd week back to Vyshhorod, but the city was closed by the military. I was able to come back on the 5th week and already was with the church. And in September we began serving in Vyshgorod, where I live, there is now 7,500 refugees in our town, in our area, 700 of which are registered with our church. We have regular ministry to them, or we can do that. And the first meeting, I'll never forget, talking about, you know, talking about the Christian counseling, like I'm coming to that. We brought these 300 people that went all from the east, Avdeyevka, you know, Bakhmut, all those places. We brought 300 of those. As we are finishing the first meeting, I come to the first lady. I said, my name is Alexander. What's your name? She said, my name is Galina. I said, could me tell your story? She said, you want to hear my story? It's like maybe I asked something wrong. She said, I'll tell you my story. She says, we were leaving Avdeyevka under the heavy fire. The car was with holes everywhere, with my son and my daughter-in-law. And in the back of my car were two dead bodies of my grandchildren of 5 and 15, which we went to bury to the Western Ukraine. Of course, at that time, I would not know what to say to somebody like that, which, you know, pressed us to begin to learn how to deal with that. At the first teaching that we organized that September, you know, and we are doing that systematically now, talking about the psychological trauma and Christian counseling, well, from different sides, we are learning how to deal with the PTCR, post-trauma syndrome, trying to serve these people. Now, I know what I would say. You know, do you know what to say to somebody like this? Two things. I've got no idea what you went through. No idea, not the foggiest idea what you went through. Is there any way I could help you? In any way, please allow me to help you. That's what you say to somebody who went through hell like that, okay? Anyway, we go on. And the next thing that happened there actually is a forced migration. This is actually what happened in Ukraine. You see in the north, that's where we've been hit from, right from the Belarus territory. That territory, when they hit, had that only 110 kilometers, maybe 120 kilometers to the capital, they came on the 24th of February and they've been pushed away on the 2nd of April. So that's like what? 1 month and 1 week. We were surrounded by the enemy. And they actually have been pushed first from the northern part. Then you look further east from the Chernigiv, Sumy, Kharkiv territory. And all the blue area is where the enemy has been actually expelled from. You also see a bit of blue here on the bottom. The red part is all actually occupied territory still. And that is Kherson. Kherson has been freed actually the latest right there. And we still have to actually free those territories. Right now, in the beginning, almost 8 million Ukrainians left west. By today's figure, it's 4.9 official registered by the government, people who went to the west. In reality, I think it's definitely over 5 million. The church of 300 members, 100 people gone. 100% of our people gone. 21 family has left our church. It's really been a challenge right now. People with money and the gifting, those who's been the middle-age families, they actually left. We are trying to live now in new realities. Now, within the country, also we had almost the same figure, 5 million people that some of them actually, this is what actually happened. There is a part of the refugees within the country that decided not to leave west. They left maybe the war zone only 50 to 100 kilometers. Cities like Dnieper, like Zaporozhye, cities like Mykolaiv, cities like that are a bit further. Some people still wanted to be in their more or less territory. They're not heavily actually bombed, but the big part of the country moved actually west completely. And that's where a huge amount of the people living. Altogether, like I said, 5 million within and 5 million outside of the country. So as we go on, what is the answer to that? The first thing that we did, Christian churches massively engaged in the evacuation. I mean, like I said yesterday on the stage, that the first entity that switched on and did something to the people was the church. Really. In our Kyiv region, there's been two churches Nobody would want to come to the northern part because it is, I live where the Bucha Irpin, that's the same area. Our town was only saved because 12 kilometers from us, they exploded a Kiev dump. And the Kiev water dam is 3 meters higher than the rivers here. And the one small river became like a Dnieper River wide. That's why they didn't cross to us, to our town and Vyshgorod town, by the miracle of God, because of the exploded town and the water, they couldn't cross to us. That's why they went to European Bucha. And that's why, you know, our network had two base churches where minibuses and people with cars tried and took the people from the dangerous territories. And I told you some of the figures yesterday that we've evacuated. Three people from our network died. One guy is Sergei Ilyin. He died in the north. And actually, I've given Yaroslav, he's seen the picture of that completely, you know, with holes, minibus. 6 kids, I visited him in the June. Prayed with his wife, I cried with his wife. Because he's died, as we say, on my territory. You know, my territory, because I look after the Kiev region in our network. And there is another guy, actually, who from our network died there, just a few miles up north. Another guy from our rehab center, a sniper shot him in the eye. So that is just in those first, weeks, those people who've been trying to evacuate and do something, they've had some killed people. Churches were the first to actually offer shelters, where people who left their homes could find shelter. It's amazing. You know, people moved from the north, that's where I live, where the danger was very close. They moved actually in the southern part of the Kiev region, and that's where it was filled with people. And we were feeding them. We were just, you know, giving them all we could, actually, just to stand and support them. Some came with cats and dogs. It was the most difficult. I love cats and dogs, but not that much, believe you me. Man, this lady is just walking into the church with all these kids, and she's walking around and just like, dear God, just let's fry that thing. I'm okay, I shouldn't say. Just don't bring that thing here, because other people are reacting to that. But I guess that's the reality of life at that time. And of course, another thing, later on, we began to organize a shelter mobile homes from different sources. For instance, this town not far from Irpin, a village called Dmitrivka. That's our rehab center, big rehab center. Slavic, brother Slavic actually is running there. In that village, there was a huge tank battle. After that war, in May, there's been on the site 11 Russian tanks completely kind of destroyed. And I stood there, and there's been a lot of places where people lived in the greenhouses, lived in the garages. And this rehab center there in this village, you know, a lot of people had no shower, so they just made some showers. And thank God that we had some humanitarian aid to give people, just a chance to have a shower and wash their clothing, put the washing. So we really tried to do all we could in every way. And now a bunch, especially one of our churches, has about 8 of those small, 3 by 6 meters mobile homes in different places, actually. That's another thing that we're doing right now. So we go on. And the next, another thing I need to say. Where we live in the village called Khatyanivka, across the power station, across the river, we found a hostel that was built, you know, like for the 2012, you know, World Cup, or European Football Cup. And that thing was empty like for months. Right now, it's filled with people. Most unfortunate people who have no money to live anywhere else, they live there. We go there every week. And Yaroslav was there with me a couple of weeks ago. And it was hurting to see a mother of 80 sleeping in the same bed with a disabled son of 54. So, and we are trying to do all we could actually to undertake and make their life a little bit easier. They said, please bring us some benches just for us to go outside. Most of the people who live there, they're all those who are 60 and up, actually. So, and about 100 of them actually live in there. Together with Yaroslav, we went and visited them and again. So there are many places like this where either people living in the public places like this or in mobile places, we're trying to serve them all we could. Economy. To begin with, I have to say that 30% of the Ukrainian GDP is gone. It's not there. 30%. Ukraine overall had an industrial east, and south and west more agricultural. So that's why, you know, our east was destroyed, our economy. You know, where we've been making all the metal, places where we've been having, we had not one single oil refinery, not one single one. Everything was bombed. All our gas, petrol and diesel is brought from Romania, Bulgaria, Poland, Baltic states, all of that. We had no one because all of them have been bombed. We didn't have enough, at that time, missiles to defense system to protect ourselves. So then I have to say that our agricultural south, because of mines, Ukraine is the most infiltrated with mines country in the world. Over 30% of our land is not good for farming. And that's like South Kherson, Odessa region. And not only that, the Black Sea, that's where we sold our wheat from. Mykolaiv, Odessa port is completely closed. It's actually run by Russia. So industrial east and south, which is agricultural today, is killed. For instance, there was one day where there's been no salt. In Artyomovsk, there's the biggest mine of salt. And last year, suddenly, there was no salt. It's like no salt in the country. It's like, hello, you know? So it was a time we had to really adapt and find from somebody. They killed the biggest chicken factory. 1.8 million chicken have been destroyed. 1.8 million, the biggest chicken factory was destroyed also. So suddenly, Easter last year, the eggs were like $2 per dozen, two and a half. So it's like, hello, what's next? You know, petrol, you know, salt, eggs. It's been like this the first year. So, and of course, a million men who've joined the army. People who were working, who've been creating GDP, they're now standing for the country. I could go on. Our currency lost from 1 to 28 to a dollar to 1 to 40. So our currency lost almost 50% of its value. So I could go on. So economy is really a big. All the Western business is gone. Oh, you go to all supermarkets, a lot of those shops, they're not there. They're in the West. McDonald's came back. Kentucky Fried Chicken is, you know, has been there actually. But the Swedish big store is not there. And all these other closed store, probably a good dozen of them, they've closed their business, they're gone, they're waiting the end of the war. So all those things, like I said, economically, they put us in a very difficult situation right now. Thank God for the Western partners, who I really have to say that who've been standing with us. I mean, to say more directly, been feeding us. And some of them at not an easy expense on your side. And I hope our country will never forget once we have the victory over this, you know, horrible enemy, that we'll see good results. So that's economy. We've tried to answer that with humanitarian aid. It's amazing. Our government, next slide, our government very quickly, before the war, I would have nothing to do with humanitarian aid because the whole, you know, thing with humanitarian aid was so difficult. You know, you had to do so many reports. Somebody received some package of humanitarian aid, had to sign and also give the passport copy. So I said, forget the humanitarian aid before the war. But of course, quickly, our government made some adjustments, and it was really easy for us to receive, you know, all those things. We've really tried to help people with hygiene, help people with food, help people with different things. Even the army people, like yesterday, my administrator called me on the phone. Well, actually, he wrote to me. He said, the army base that is only on 2 miles from us, they approached us. They need 400 liters of bottled water. So guess what? We give them the water in 2 days because they protect us. I mean, there are 200 people there who are in the fields up north there in the Chernihiv region. We're trying to serve those guys with the basic stuff. We go in there and preach to them. You know, in June, we came to the anniversary party to the military base, and we could share Jesus with them. Right, there's things that were not possible before the war. Some doors that have been opened is absolutely incredible. What's to do with people, with the war? I still say today, I've been talking to a few organizations, humanitarian organizations. I've been saying, guys, you could drop people who live in their homes, but don't drop the refugees. Just please don't. People who are 60, 70, and 80 who left their homes, who came to a strange place, they got no chance. They really have no chance to survive. So I said, please, if it's in your power at all, let's still look after those refugees who are living everywhere, you know, around Ukraine. They really need help, especially there. And with those, within those, the good thing that I like, there's 700 refugees that we have joined our church. Well, I mean, registered with our church. 90% of them are people who are 55, 60, and older. The younger one, they're looking for a job, which I have a lot of respect for them, you know. They're younger, they have a chance, and they do their best, actually, you know, in the country. So I guess those are the things that we are trying to do. Of course, the church is not a producer of any, you know, industrial kind of thing, but, you know, on the practical, and like we say, you know, I have a lady, actually, who is coming regularly to our refugee meetings. We began to, just I'll come back in a second, we began to have a Bible class for them. 11 o'clock on every Wednesday, they come to hear the gospel. Some of them are preparing for water baptism. Just a couple of weeks ago, a man, maybe 72, responded to the gospel. And I came to him. He came forward to pray a sinner's prayer. I said, where are you from? He says, Lugansk. And he was crying. I stood there thinking, God in heaven, with all the horror of the war, what else chance did he have to hear the gospel? He had to experience all this horror to come here, to sit as a refugee in the meeting and respond at the age of 72 to the gospel. I cried with him, you know, and he's now coming to the Bible class, a guy like that. So in all the horror and stuff, there are, of course, good side that is God doing also. I have one lady who said this, 3 times I moved from the time I ran from the West Ukraine, each time it was the church. 3 times it was the church, not the government, that transported me from the red zone, then transported me to another place, and then transported me actually here to where I live right now. Right now we have people who come, right now we have a guy, 28, from the Petrivtsi village, next village, he's with no leg. He's coming every Sunday, last 3 weeks, and it's just, it's all together. You think, you only read that in the books, and you've seen that in the movies. The guys with the military uniform sitting there in the service with no leg. We're trying to help him now to actually find a prosthesis, either Germany or America. We're working actually on that. That is all the reality of the war today. Family, that's the huge one. Like I said, in our church, we have, I think, it was 11, now I think it's 9 families that are apart. Women are Canada, Germany, Italy, Switzerland. We already have almost, unless a God's miracle happens, 2 families that fell apart because of that. One is divorced already. Another one is only God will help them if they don't divorce. We had situations where one family with 4 kids, they talked like that the first day. If you don't leave with me now, our family is gone. There is no family. If you don't leave with me that morning. The dynamics of the war, you never know. She said to her husband, I will leave you. Our family is over if we don't go with me right now to leave the country. So all that is, like I said, the dynamics of the war, you could never predict. You never know what's next. Because when people are threatened, when there is this existential problem, I say this, we're going through all this, unless an existential problem is solved, you cannot talk to 90% of the people. They're just not here. The instinct of self-protection is so strong for probably 80 or 90% that you can never predict actually anything. So we are now at the point where we're only reaching out. We're still in the active war. That's why I cannot say that actually we are already fully, we are now looking into this and trying to do our best to help these kind of families. I called after the first divorce, the first trial of our family, I called each other 8 men. I called them, I talked to them. I said, hey, you have to really count all the all the possible loss. You know, your wife's being not there with you. So, yeah. But on the other hand, you also, you never know how people react to the bombing. It's so funny. I have a son of 25, Benjamin. And I have other families who one person, when the bombing is happening, people seem to react okay. There's another person you could never, before the war, you could never tell that their mind is actually melting once the explosion happened. You sometimes think, well, this one would never be afraid. But then you think, no, unpredictable. My middle son, each time there's a bombing, he goes to the West Ukraine. He goes to the grandpa. I said, come on, Benjamin, you're a man. He says, yes, I know, but I can't do nothing. It's just here. It's really here when the explosions are happening. So now we have learned now to differentiate between the drones and the missiles. The missiles carry 300, 400, 500 kilograms of explosives. You better don't play with that. Drones, big deal. That's only like 30 kilo explosions. You know, they can hit you in the head. Maybe then they'll kill you. But if it's somewhere, there's not a big probability the drones will kill you. So a lot of us living there, we say drones, we don't really, don't hide from drones. So that's just like you learn to live in an environment. You know what I mean? And I guess, like we said, women abroad, men are either fighting or, you know that men between 18 and 60 cannot leave the country right now. Me being here, it takes me nobody. It's like nobody can leave the country. Men, the first, I think the war began on the 4 in the morning, I think 9 o'clock, 6 hours later, borders would not allow men through. 18 to 60, men cannot leave the country. Our solicitors of our network have to work a week and a half for me to be here. Papers, documents, and they really read my paper 5 times at the border in the train. You know, that it's a legitimate paper that I'm here. So, yeah, that's still a challenge, big challenge for us to solve the family situation. And let's look at this one. Serving children in education. What we're actually trying to do, you got to understand that 2 years of the COVID and 1 year of the war, it's almost 4 years kids are not at school. They're already writing that this generation where 4 years kids are not at school is going to show big times in the following years. They say in our country that 70-80% of the kids cannot study online. Maybe in the West where it's already a set system, it's already a walkthrough thing, maybe it's better. But in our system, COVID was the first time where online study was introduced, you know? So that's why we're still on the way to learn the kids actually to study online. And especially when the war began, they bomb one area, there is no lights. Where there's a teacher, there is no electricity. So where there are students, there is electricity. And they just cannot, the teacher cannot go online just to have a lesson. So that's why, you know, we had to do, you know, some things. Actually, we now actually have made, together with Yaroslav, we made a educational program where kids are invited. Our Sunday school was 150 kids before the war. It was a huge kids ministry, 9 classes of, ask me how many a day, 40. That is the most painful thing for me, to have like 2/3, 70% of the kids gone. Of course, kids were the first ones to be taken from the war. But that is a really difficult thing. So now we're working with the refugee kids, actually. We've signed this new educational thing. We began actually with, what we're trying to do, we're trying to bring the school lessons to them, encourage them to catch up a little bit with the math, with other subjects like that. And it grew now from 4 lessons to 10. And now our educational program for non-believers in the church is bigger than the Sunday school. You know, they're coming, and we're getting to know them. Last Sunday, we actually had the parents' meeting of those non-believing families. I met them, I talked to them, and we're developing this thing for the spring. Hopefully, it's going to... another thing, we in the church have a Christian school, Joy School, Google, and a daycare. It was a miracle we could save, actually, the school and the daycare last September. Thank God, you know, we had 80 kids and 40 in the daycare. When the war happened in September, we had only 45 kids. Now we're growing back, and for September, that's a good sign. 22 kids signed to be in the first class, which, you know, probably means, you know, people are coming back, they're going to plan and live there in town. So there are other educational things that we are kind of thinking right now, but again, the active phase of war, you plan to do something? Okay, we're going to begin this Bible study from this week, and then another bombing, it's like, okay, everybody's living in suspense. You just put, you know, move ahead a little bit. You just change the dates again. You change the dates again. Last September, I called one of my former home group leaders, and I said to him, okay, brother, are we going to begin the home group? That's, I guess, a challenge also. I said, because some people are locked in. I took the breath to say the next word. He says, Pastor, before you say anything, I am one of those locked in. Don't ask me anything. I'm here, but I'm not here. I have two kids. You know, we're going to understand that I don't know what's next. So that's probably a challenge. Again, over the time, we're learning to live with this. That's a very new. Before the war, we definitely, over the years, had a chaplain in the prison. When the war began in 2014, some chaplaincy in Ukraine actually began from 2014. But now, after this war began, the chaplaincy really became a very wide thing. And the reason for that, of course, because the soldiers were standing in our towns and streets on the crossroads. So we had to feed them from the day they were. So the soldiers were everywhere. There are like thousands and thousands of them. You know, so that's why from the block, from the checking points where we lived to the military, camps or everywhere, you know, we get acquainted with these kind of soldiers, and now we're going regularly, almost, I guess, every more or less, good-sized church now goes to the east or south, helping the soldiers with generators. In the winter, we would make those special furnaces, weld them, and made thousands of them to take to the guys, thousands. We still make today, some of those furnaces where you cook, and there's a huge connection now. There's at least two military bases that call our church regularly. Like I said yesterday, they called us and they said, 200 men, we need 500 liters of bottled water. We need some medicine, you know, some fever medicine. So there's a huge locally co-working with the army, with the soldiers, and of course, going to the east where people are really there in the battle. In our church, we have Yuri, one in the war. We have another guy. We have three men who are fighting. And of course, in our men's church group, we are praying for them regularly. One of them just wrote a couple of days ago. They were in Marinka. Marinka, that's where the war began, actually, even in 2014. He says, we had to walk 4.5 kilometers. It was a really dangerous walk, me to take my six men to my line. And he said, the first day, it was more or less okay. Second day, 16 mines fell around me. None of them exploded. Thank God, you know, like that guy said, the Russians' mines are very good. I guess, or maybe I should give the glory to God, you know, but that's, I don't know which one. And he said, the third day, they called us, they covered us with phosphor. What do you call this? Special, an English word is that, phosphor? That are really given high temperature. And he said, we only were alive because we last second, we jumped into the garage. We were not killed that day. So that's what we live every day with still today, in the situation we're in. But again, this whole chaplaincy, helping the army locally and to the front line is really wide right now by everybody. Because Putler, that's how I call him, Putler, he didn't know that he's not fighting the Ukrainian army. He's fighting Ukrainian nation. Because every single grandma counts, it's a must to do something, you know, just to see the victory of this evil empire. All right, Grove Church, last one, okay. Friends, on one hand, churches have emptied. On the other hand, let's talk about our region. Even in the better years, we never, in 12 months, established 4 churches. In 12 months, in Kyiv region, we established 4 churches in Brovary. We established a church in Uzin. south of Kyiv region. We established a church in Bila Tserkva. There's a big district there, Pishchani called, 30,000 people, you know. And we also established a church in Kagarlik. That's all more or less towns. Like, it's like in 12 months. Explain that. And most of the times, it actually began with the refugee groups that were there. Big times, of course, local people joined in. Also in the east, when you look about talk about towns like Mykolaiv, in our network, that church, when the war began, Pastor Andriy Serdan told me, I think it was only 100 people. But then another 800 people came. It's like other places, Kharkiv, Zaporozhye, other places that were maybe within a plus minus 100 kilometers from the war zone, people came there to be helped practically and also spiritually. So there is this eastern, group of people who came from the east in different parts of the Ukraine, west, central, and even closer to the east. We're seeing a lot of salvations, a lot of baptisms right now. And that is something that probably we will never see unless this horrible thing kind of happened. So churches are growing. I could not say that they're systematically every growing. There are different pockets like thing, but overall that is the case actually in Ukraine.
There is very interesting phenomena in Ukraine nowadays that the prayer is a tool of evangelization. So people really want to pray. Just unchurched people, and we can say unbelievers, people want to pray for Ukraine. So they often ask how to pray, because we don't know how to do this. So therefore, it's growing some prayer movements that try to focus the prayer on Ukraine and within, not only, let's say, unite the earth with heaven, but also giving some during this prayer, focusing, giving some biblical vision of the country, how God wants to see Ukraine in the future, in different spheres of society. So, for example, there are some prayer events, interdenominational prayer events. We, our ministry, our network is very involved in this. We print prayer books, which help people to pray. This one, we printed 1 million of copies in the beginning of the war, and it's gone very, very quickly.
Every humanitarian bag of food, each one of them gets one of those prayer meetings in the bag with the food, each one of them.
Yeah, and also to soldiers through chaplain ministry that we cooperate with three big associations of chaplains. So it's in people used to say that in trenches there is not atheists. So there everybody believe in God. So. Yeah. So therefore it's some tools. My son is working on the app now, Prayer for Ukraine in smartphone. So this is like. Really, to and I remember within the Christian Open Academy, which is our educational project about preparing Christian leaders for public sphere. We had a group in Zoom when we shared, and I remember one lady before the anniversary of the war, 24 February. She said that in her business group. She said that we will have a fast and prayer for Ukraine, 24 February 2023. And non-believers people said, we want to join you. We want to join in this fasting. We want to join in this prayer. Show us how to do this. Help us. Give us some instructions. So people really are very open for prayer, especially for prayer for Ukraine. So for all these purposes, churches unite, make some networks for cooperation. So therefore, for example, we with Pastor Sasha and many other well-known leaders from different evangelical denominations, also we create such a network, and we together create some teams, and we do different of these projects, which you saw, like our response to all these challenges, to all these needs. So this is the time for action, really. This is the time for acting. Even I can say that this is a time of exam for the church. So we had more than 30 years of great freedom, religious freedom in Ukraine. We had a great possibility to growing, to learning, to study, to prepare ourselves, and now is a time of exam. So, and I think the church is going quite well this exam, especially in social work, but in public work, I think we could be prepared a little better. Could you distinguish this, like social aspect and public aspect? So social work is addressed to the individual, to need people, to people who are in need. And really, like many, I always travel throughout Ukraine, in different regions, especially in eastern Ukraine. So I had many like such statements from people that if the church don't help us, we will be lost, really. So in social aspect, church did great work. Church is connected with their brothers and sisters abroad. So therefore is a huge humanitarian aid from different countries because of this. Like we are one family, yeah? So we have connections always. We have relationship. But in public life, I believe that using all these 30 years of freedom, we could be prepare some better. And some problem of the church is a lack of like worldview preparation, theological preparation that deal with all these events that happened. For example, it's a big question for many, even still, on theoretical level, pacifism versus just war. How to be with using gun? How to be with killing people now, even in defense? So biggest majority of believers before the war were absolutely pacifists. And they understand intuitionally that they need defense. But how to answer this on the level of theory, on the level of worldview, on the like how to make it order in our minds, yeah. So it was a lot of discussions in this way. So, or for example, such a notion like theology of nation, how to be with this theology of we see how history is creating right now. We see every day history is creating. So it happened dates which our kids will study in school. Yeah, but to shape this history, and the church could do this now, you need to understand how history is creating. You need to be prepared with this. Or for example, understanding the historical process, how to be with patriotism. For example, patriotism, it's something evidential for today. It's something which the nation really need now, patriotism. But what should be a model of patriotism? What is the difference between patriotism or like, let's say, chauvinism or something like this, yeah? So this is a very, very fundamental issues that people before the war, they thought, oh, this is something abstractive. But when it came, and with the came, you see that it's very ethical issues. It's very, very deep spiritual issues. And I think it may be even for us. We don't know what will happen in our countries in 5 or 7 years. Will we be in different countries prepared to these events? Like, for example, development of technologies. If we are ready, or theology, or worldview to all these challenges. So other questions, like for example, music, Christian music. We need before the war, a lot of great songs, Christian biblical songs about Ukraine. And now I believe that even non-believers people could song them and sing them, sing them, if we will have it. But many people didn't think about this in proper time. So it is very important to, like in the Bible is written that you will be a head, not a tail, yeah? So I mean, I believe that it not means that you will be like in authorities or you will be rich. You will predict some things and you will be in future already in your thinking, in your preparing yourself. And when the future came, like when the event happened, you will be ready. You will be ready to give response to people. So public sphere is negligent. And fourthly, in many, many aspects. So the church is like now doing this fasting, prepare themselves during events. So please pray for Ukraine.